Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show, brought to you by ChrisKresser.com. I'm your host, Steve Wright from SCDLifestyle.com, and with me is integrative medical practitioner, licensed acupuncturist, and healthy skeptic, Chris Kresser. How's it going?
I'm doing pretty well, Steve. How are you?
I'm pretty jacked tonight. We have a very special guest on the line.
Yeah, I'm excited to introduce Dan Pardy. Dan and I met at Paleo FX. Actually, we'd been on each other's radar before that, but we finally met at Paleo FX, and it was we hit it off right away. I think we share similar perspective on a lot of this stuff, and we spent some time together and got to know each other, and then we hung out a little bit at AHS, and we've become fast friends. And so I have a lot of respect for Dan and his work, and I'm really excited to have him here on the show. And I'm going to have Dan introduce himself and tell you a little bit about how he came to this work and you know, what his perspective is. And then we're going to spend the rest of the episode talking about sleep. So Dan, why don't you say hello to everyone and tell them, you know, a little bit about yourself and where you're coming from.
Great. Thanks for the introduction, Chris. I'll tell you, it's a real honor to be here because I learned so much from you and this podcast. So it's a real pleasure. And I'm excited to talk about some concepts related to sleep today. And yeah, I'll tell you a little bit more about myself. So I'm a researcher and I work with the Department of Neurology and Endocrinology at Leiden University in the Netherlands. And I work with the Behavioral Sciences Department at Stanford University. And I look at how chronic sleep deficiency, or not getting enough sleep on a chronic basis, how that affects things like decision-making and weight gain, just a couple of areas that have been of interest to me for a long time. I got into sleep probably 10 years ago. I was working at a pharmaceutical company that was working in rare disorders and had a sleeping drug for narcolepsy. And with that, I started going to scientific conferences on a, you know, yearly basis and was just trying to soak up as much information as I could, because as soon as I started to learn about it, the doors opened up and I, you know, couldn't learn enough. It's an endlessly fascinating topic, I find, and how it leads to personal insight about yourself or others, our health. And so over time, I started to think about, I had done some academic research in the past on lifestyle factors like diet and stress management and exercise. And a lot of these different disciplines that I had explored started to coalesce into some ideas about how to help to facilitate health in others. And I created this model for behavior change. And the idea was that it would look at a variety of different influences on behavior and try to harness those in a way that would enable somebody to live a healthy lifestyle more easily. And from that, I started to work, try to operationalize the model. And friends called it Dan's Plan because I talked to him about what I was doing. And the name kind of stuck, and it seemed memorable, so I, you know, rolled with it. And yeah, so now the idea with, you know, with Dan's Plan is simple. We try to take the best practice guidance about, you know, what is the information that is most helpful to help us live in a, you know, in a way that is going to facilitate health, and try to filter it through this behavioral model, which uses things like behavioral economics and persuasive technology. And the idea is to try to simplify a person's health practice, to try to make it as easy as possible for them to live a healthy lifestyle on a day-by-day basis. So that's what we do. And, you know, I think that the, you know, one other thing that I'll say is that the thesis that we're working off of is that a lot of modern illness is a result of what we call a broken lifestyle. And that is this lifestyle that's in discordance with our biology. And that because of this is facilitated by a lot of modern luxuries. And so instead of having a lot of our health behaviors be predicated on survival behaviors, we now have an option to really not engage with things that keep us healthy. And so therefore, if you want to be healthy, you have to cultivate and maintain a personal health practice. Because right now we actually have the option not to. And so we try to look at what are the things that are going to make that health practice effective to keep you, you know, free of disease, maintaining full physical function, and have the highest quantity of health within your lifespan. So that's a little bit about me and what I do. And
cool. Thanks, Dan. And for the record, everybody, Dan's plan is excellent. I recommend it to all of my patients. It's the best tool that I know of for tracking the most important factors in changing your lifestyle and, you know, meeting your health related goals. And it's completely free. So you should definitely go check it out. It's at danceplan.com. You can set up an account, you can set up your weight goals and your sleep goals and your movement and activity goals. And then there are a lot of really cool tools to help you stay on track. There's great emails that he sends out every day with suggestions for exercise and activity and recipes and other hardware tools that interface with Dan's plan, like the Fitbit and the Withings scale, that can make it really easy to track your data and get it up into Dan's plan. So definitely check it out. I think it's definitely the way of the future in terms of this kind of tracking.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Dan. So let's begin by talking about some fundamentals of sleep, because I think even though sleep, you know, we talk about it a lot, we hear about it a lot, I think everyone knows a little something about the importance of sleep, but there are still some things that we don't know about sleep. And I find that pretty interesting after all this time researching it. But let's begin with, you know, why do we even need sleep? How does it work? And what are some of the key metrics to consider when we talk about measuring sleep?
No, it's a great question. You know, this question of the purpose of sleep has really been elusive to researchers, and I think it might actually have to do with the nature of the question itself, as though we're trying to identify a singular purpose for sleep, when really there might be hundreds of purposes to sleep. So many things that it does to kind of work in a reciprocal fashion to what's happening during the day, so that we are, you know, better prepared for the next day once we engage with sleep. So that kind of grand purpose is, again, still eludes us. And there's definitely a lot, you know, it's like every scientific study, it concludes with more research is needed. Every time you go down one path, it opens up more doors. And that's perhaps the frustrating thing about science, but also, you know, one of the wonderful things too. So the structure of sleep it's very complex and active and highly organized. And so we used to think that sleep was just this period of behavioral quiescence. So the mind, the body kind of shutting down and relaxing. But we know now that there are parts of the brain that are more active during sleep than they are at any other point during a 24-hour period. Mm. So we also know that the structure and the sequencing of the sleep stages, there's different sleep stages that we go through over the course of the night, and different research will look into, you know, what are the important aspects of these different stages, how about the rhythmicity, so how they flow together. And the three real kind of cardinal, you know, features about sleep, the keys, are timing, intensity, and duration. And there's so much more to talk about, but those three things are really critical. So timing has to do with your bedtime and your wake time. Mm-hmm. So that's going to talk about that timing within a 24-hour period. Then there is duration. Okay, that's easy. That's the length of time that you sleep within that period. And then also intensity, which refers to the depth of sleep. And mm-hmm. you could spend 8 hours sleeping, and if you only stay in lighter stages of sleep, you're not going to really reap any benefits of sleep. So you're going to wake up feeling like you got no sleep at all, and you're going to feel that way too. So the depth of sleep has been looked at for, you know, as a marker of quality, but it really has to do with both the depth of sleep, the cyclicity of sleep. So there's definitely a lot kind of going, you know, mm-hmm. going on there. And you could, you know, endless, the whole conversation could be about right. just looking at these different structures, but I think that's probably good.
Mm-hmm. And there are certain health conditions, like I think there's some pretty interesting research about fibromyalgia and non-restorative sleep, where a lot of people with fibromyalgia are only get it, you know, in stage one, stage two, maybe some stage three, but they don't go into deep sleep and their muscles are never able to fully, you know, restore themselves. So they have this constant soreness as a result, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to. If you've had a few nights of poor sleep, what happens to your muscles and your recovery after those, that period of time?
That's right. There's others. You know, sleep can be truncated, so you can lose sleep by just simply not being in bed long enough. You can miss out on certain stages, or then the architecture or that rhythmicity that I was talking about, so how the stages flow back to back, that can be disrupted too. And all of it can lead to these cardinal features of poor sleep, so feeling sleepy, mental impairment, physical impairment. So it can get disrupted in a variety of ways. But you know, achieving good sleep is also something that a lot of us can do when we kind of do the right things on a daily basis, and you know, we'll talk about that more later.
Let's talk about that in particular, because I read something just the other, a couple of days ago, I think, that a third of Americans are getting less than 6 hours of sleep a night, which just strikes me as like an alarming epidemic, probably one of the most shocking statistics I've heard recently. And if we want to talk about things that are going to send our health off of a cliff, of course we talk about, you know, diet and lack of physical activity and things like that. But I'm thinking that this single statistic is probably scarier than anything else in terms of its potential impact on our health.
Yeah, we're getting 20% less sleep per night on average than we were 40 years ago. And these are statistics from the National Sleep Foundation, which does sleep polls every few years. So around in the 1960s, average sleep times were about 8.5 hours per night, or at least times in bed or self-reported sleep times. And there was a assessment of subjective sleep time in the early 1900s, and it was about the same as it was in 1960s, so about 8.5 hours. And there's been a slow and steady decline in sleep times. And now, on average, the average is 6.5 hours per night for working adults, and then about 7 hours and 20 minutes on the weekends, and trying to play catch up. And
that doesn't even reflect the quality of sleep. So it's possible that those 6.5 hours, it's not only shorter than our, you know, traditional norm, but those 6.5 hours are poorer quality than they have normally been.
Well, it's very possible. In some senses, sleep has the ability to almost compress. So it's compensatory in that when you get less sleep one night, the staging, the depth of sleep will try to do what its best to try to, you know, get that sleep back, to try to recover lost sleep, right? Mm-hmm. But there's also these factors that one big important factor is at light in our environment. In fact, light, artificial light, is listed as a probable carcinogen by the World Health Organization.
Wow.
And I think that's because when we have a lot of artificial light in our homes, we're staring at iPads and TVs, right? We're getting engaged. There's light will directly stimulate the cortex, and it acts like a cup of coffee. So it's this fallacy to think, well, I'm going to just read my iPad until I'm sleepy, right? Because it's keeping you up. And so even if you're getting less sleep on a nightly basis, it's actually, there are reasons that this sleepiness is getting masked by the environment in our homes in the evening. And that can then, you know, set your circadian rhythms, which we'll talk about in a little bit, that can get, you know, them off so that the necessary rhythms in the body become out of sync. And there are very real consequences to that, including much higher incidences of cancers, coronary heart disease, metabolic disease like diabetes. So, yeah, I agree with you, Chris. I think that this is one of the most significant issues that we're facing in our health today.
So when you're talking about the artificial light, and we're talking about a decline of 2 hours, you know, plus or minus a little bit from the 60s, which I wasn't around in the 60s, but I hear they didn't have iPads and the TVs were like a different type. They're like round or something. I guess it was weird.
And they weren't 70 inches on the wall.
Yeah, yeah. Like the programming stopped at night or something and people went to bed. Yeah. So,
imagine that.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, do you guys really think that that extra 2 hours is also, you know, technology based? That are we compounding it? We're losing hours in bed and replacing those with artificial light hours?
Well, there's probably a variety of things that are, culpable in why we're getting less sleep. One of them, I think, a very real issue is our technology, because it will mask the sleepiness. Not only, is the light going to keep you up and be an artificial stimulant, but also, what are you doing? You're maybe doing work, playing Angry Birds, whatever that is. That's going to engage you and mentally stimulate you as well. So that's one thing. But then there's also things like longer work times and longer commute times. And so, you know, to some degree, people are trying to just find more personal time for themselves and their family. And they're getting home at 8 o'clock at night and they want to spend, have a little time to themselves. So there are those sorts of factors that are also kind of shaping, I think, this new existence.
You think there's been a cultural shift too, as well? Like this kind of idea of I'll sleep when I'm dead, and a lot of the biohacking ideas out there, where the folks can believe that they get by just fine on 4 hours of sleep. I don't know if those trends seem to have been around for a while. I don't know how. I can't imagine that kind of conversation was happening in the 60s.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know. I don't know how new they are, but there is that modern mindset of just trying to get, maximize performance over your day. There's being so much that's being asked of you, and there's people sending work emails at like 2 a.m. and there's probably some, subconscious, communication about look how hard I'm working, look how dedicated I am, but then. There's also like, hey, look how well I can do with less sleep. It's like it's almost like a bravado well. So there's a lot of different forces that are shaping this, and some of them are kind of again subconscious, and some of them are more more the mindset that we're operating under.
Yeah, I think there's a boundary issue with the way that one of the benefits or the promises of modern technology is that it sort of untethers us from the traditional, office environment and 9-to-5 work schedule. But one of the downsides of that is that now, as you've pointed out, you can be on vacation, you can be at home at 10 at night, you can be at home on Sunday or out doing errands, and there are work emails coming in if you have your phone set up for that, which a lot of people do. And so you pretty much never have a break if you do set it up that way from work. And I think human nature, it's hard for a lot of people to resist that. If it's possible, a lot of people will do it. And so I personally feel like that has a huge impact on people's sleep rhythms and just their ability, as you said earlier, if they're on their iPad and they're doing something and an email pops in at 10 o'clock at night, it may be hard for them to resist checking it. And then they check it and it's like a big fire at work that needs to be put out. And so all of a sudden they've shifted into a state where they might've been relaxing and kind of getting ready for sleep into like a, an activated stress response because of something that's happening, that's work related.
I was thinking about something very similar earlier today, Chris, and I agree in some senses that, this great benefit of untethering us from just being at a desk 9-to-5, but then it follows us everywhere. And it's, I think the only real vacation these days is the one without cell reception,
That's so. Right. I purposely look for places like that at this point. They're harder and harder to find now.
Yeah. So I think what's going to happen is there needs to be some public awareness about, some of the negative consequences, particularly within work environments. So showing the employers that if you want a really good, happy, productive person, they need to have They need rest. They need an off period. And it's got to make it, you have to make it somewhat of a, you know, culture, a part of the culture to regard sleep as something that is going to help you perform on a daily basis. You know, like you wouldn't go to work and have a glass of alcohol, you know, it's just not culturally acceptable. And so I think, you know, getting sleep time and not sending emails really late at night, that's going to, I think, hopefully imbue into kind of the work culture. And so there'll be less pressure to kind of conform to what your workmates are doing.
Mm-hmm. Let's just dive in a little more deeply to the consequences of sleep deprivation. I mean, I'm sure most of my listeners have a pretty decent idea, just even from their own personal experience. But the research on this is robust, and it's pretty scary, actually. So tell us a little bit about what you've seen in your research and just your awareness of the overall body of literature.
Yeah, the effects of sleep will affect almost all body systems and tissues, and so that can bring. And I think we're still uncovering and unraveling, you know, the effects of sleep loss on our health. And I think there's probably some, you know, impairments and consequences that are taking place that we're not even fully aware of. But you see, you know, very meaningful, consistent clinical data showing cardiovascular risk, metabolic risk, premature aging and cancers and problems with the brain. And it's, it's almost hard to find, you know, some tissues or systems that aren't really affected with chronic sleep loss. But then again, it's also newer, right? So we're getting less sleep as a society, and it's continued to go down over the last 20, 30 years. And so right now, we're at the lowest average that has ever been recorded. And so the results of today, you know, will be, it's unprecedented. We don't know what's really going to happen and how severe it can be. Mm-hmm. So
really, a big society-wide experiment.
Yeah, exactly. That is life today. Yeah.
In a number of respects. So how about more particularly on weight regulation? I saw a pretty interesting quote. I think you sent it to me that said sleep deprivation was from a study that said in that study, sleep deprivation was more a risk factor for obesity than fat intake or lack of higher intensity exercise.
Yeah, so I think this has been a line of research that has gained a lot of visibility over the last probably 10 years. And it started there were several different studies, but one of them was the Wisconsin cohort, which looked at 15,000 people and noticed that if you did a trend line, those that actually slept less tended to be higher weight and have a higher risk of being, had a much higher risk of being overweight. And it was actually this sort of U-shaped curve. So the extreme long sleepers, they also actually had higher weights as well. And the average right around 8 hours was the people that maintained the lowest weights. And so these studies were followed up with shorter perspective term studies where they took healthy young men and they would subject them to, you know, 4 hours of sleep per night. And then they would monitor some of their homeostatic hormones like leptin and ghrelin. And then they noticed that both leptin and ghrelin, which affect feeding, energy regulation, sympathetic nervous system activity, all things that will eventually help to control or influence body weight, would adjust in a manner so that you were more likely to be hungry, more likely to be storing fat, and less likely to be burning energy. So that's been followed up multiple times, both in animal studies and in humans. And additionally, we also see that there is a pretty immediate and significant impairment in glucose regulation. So the thinking is that, you know, chronic sleep deficiency is going to not only help to not only predispose you to obesity. And by the way, 81 out of 89 studies that have looked at this have found positive findings. And the risk seems to be that lack of sleep or chronic sleep restriction will increase your risk for obesity about 55%. So it's, you know, really, really, meaningful, this connection. How it's happening, I think, is still, you know, being discovered. But certainly there is, you know, the sympathetic nervous system is an autonomic process that will be much higher during the day, or when you're awake, excuse me, it's more active during wakefulness than it is during sleep. And so as we truncate our sleep times, you've got longer periods of the sympathetic nervous system activity, which might have this downstream effect on, you know, on cells or on just, you know, on cortisol. One of the downstream effects actually is cortisol. And we know that if you have higher levels of cortisol circulating, like Cushing syndrome, you can induce insulin resistance and you know, rapid fat gain. And so those are some of the areas that have been explored, but yeah, there seems to be a very clear connection between sleep loss and weight gain, and also there seems to be one between sleep loss and the increased risk of diabetes as well.
Hey, Dan or Chris, one of you two guys jumped on that rabbit hole. So when sleep, you know, poor sleep or chronic low sleep messes up my ghrelin or my leptin, which, you know, one's going to be appetite regulation, the other one's going to be appetite regulation as well, kind of, you know, tell us when we're not sleeping correctly, like, you know, tell me what's going to happen during the day. What body systems are going to malfunction because of these hormones?
Dan, maybe you could address that in relation to your research on sleep and appetite and decision making.
Yeah, sure. So these hormones will display a 24-hour cycles. And so leptin will gradually rise from the morning over the course of the day, and then it'll peak somewhere in the evening. And ghrelin will follow a little bit of a different pattern. It's considered an episodic hormone in that it waxes and wanes depending on food intake over the course of the day, but it also seems to peak in the middle of the night and then decrease. And ghrelin is a fascinating hormone, actually, because it's released from what are called oxyntic cells in the stomach, and it's thought that it will stimulate hunger. So when there's lack of food in the system for a period of time, ghrelin levels rise, and then that will make you hungry. But it also is been involved in things like reward. So it has a lot of effects on cognition as well. And it's involved in memory and reward processing. So anyway, lots of interesting stuff that's going on there. But when you, there's different ways that this can, you know, kind of be messed up. You can alter the, when you have less sleep, you actually affect the daily rhythms of both of those hormones. And again, both of them, so there's about, you know, with 2 hours less sleep per night, there's about a 15% decrease in leptin and about a 15% increase in ghrelin. So they, one goes up, one goes down, both of them, again, would predict that you would be hungrier. And that is what some research has seen, is that people tend to be a little bit more impulsive, and they tend to crave what's usually found is high carbohydrate food. And, you know, that may or may not be true, but what my research is looking at is it that they're craving high carbohydrate food, or are you actually just more impulsive and do a lot of high carbohydrate foods in your counter, in your cupboards, for example? They tend to be, you know, open package eat, right, in the typical American home. So is it the carbohydrates, or is it the kind of the quickness? It's many more steps to prepare a sandwich, or, you know, prepare a meal, I should say. But just opening a drawer and eating something, that, you know, what we know is that sleep loss makes you much less likely to work for an effort, to make an effort for a reward. And it's called effort discounting. And so you just want to basically find the fastest path to, you know, to make you happy, because you don't want to work for it. So that's what my research is looking into. And, you know, I'll share another example that is not specific to weight gain, but is really interesting. And I won't get, you know, too nerdy here, but I'll mention these two parts of the brain. So one of them is called this ventral medial prefrontal cortex. And it actually is a part of the brain that is known for, it's called the neural correlate. So this is the area of the brain that is thought to represent the estimation of gains. So if you're like any sort of risky decision making, like gambling, right? If you're about to say, how much can I win? Then this area of the brain is very responsive. A counterbalancing part of the brain is called the anterior insula, and that's thinking about all the consequences of gambling. And when you're sleep deprived, then the area that is encoding possible gains becomes very active, and the area that's encoding possible losses becomes not very active at all. So if you think about when casinos make a lot of their money, it's late at night, right? You're sleep deprived, right? Yeah. Probably you have alcohol in you too if you're in a casino, and you're much more likely to make a gamble that you ordinarily would never do. Now, right. Think about how that effect, you know, that translates into everyday life. We're in this obesogenic environment. There's food everywhere. You know, are you less likely to say no to the candy bowl as you pass it, right? You're not thinking about the consequences.
That explains why people eat that food at the casino buffet.
Something has to explain that.
does sleep also, their lack of sleep also lower dopamine? Like, are these people also kind of craving a possible dopamine hit? Is that part of it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, dopamine, there's a guy, David Rye, who studies, you know, he's one of the foremost dopamine researchers in the world. And he, you know, it's funny. He would roll. It's a good question. He would roll his eyes at it because he gets really frustrated because, you know, dopamine doesn't do just one thing in the brain. It actually is the levels stay relatively constant, particularly compared to other neurotransmitters, and particularly on over a 24-hour period. And in some areas, it's having more of kind of promoting inhibition. And in other areas, it's more excitatory. So it's hard to think of dopamine as doing one thing. It actually is having kind of pervasive effects throughout the brain as basically a signaling molecule. But we do tend to think of it as being related to pleasure and reward. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is some idea that might actually be a possibility. And we do know that, you know, with one thing that does affect dopamine signaling is light. So as you can see, like with seasonally obese animals, these are animals that become obese during certain parts of the season, you'll see a drastic reduction in dopaminergic signaling in the master clock in the brain. So dopamine signaling goes way down. And that probably has been signaled by, you know, alterations in the light-dark cycle as the seasons change. But the corresponding change in the brain is there's this big increase in noradrenergic or norepinephrine, another neurotransmitter, in another part of the brain that is involved in feeding. And so in these animals, without any increase in food intake, you see the induction of metabolic syndrome, right? They become hypercholesterolemic. They have insulin resistance. They gain weight immediately. And they basically, this is the mechanism by which the brain helps them store energy for the winter. So could that actually be happening with us, with these altered light-dark cycles? And we're not seasonally obese animals, but we also don't really fully appreciate or understand the effects of the seasons on our health and our rhythms, because it's just hard to study. So I'm not sure if that answered your question, but yeah, it's some interesting dopamine research.
Yeah, super interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more. We touched on this before, but about exactly how light does influence sleep rhythms and hormones that regulate sleep, like melatonin and cortisol.
Yeah, so light will enter into the eye, and it affects these specialized cells that are, they're called intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. Not important, but nice long scientific word. And those will transmit their signal back into this hypothalamus, which I've heard you talk about, of course, in the show before. And near that hypothalamus is the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the SCN, and that is the master clock in the brain, or in the body, okay? Mm-hmm. So this is affecting the rhythms throughout the body. And the way that it works is that master clock, through light and through the communication of light through the eye, will synchronize to the light-dark cycle of a 24-hour period. Okay, so the clock in the brain synchronizes with the environment, and then all of the clocks, because there's a clock in all cells in the body, will then synchronize with the master clock. Mm-hmm. All right, so there's two synchronizations taking place with our brain with the environment, and then the clocks throughout the body with our clock, with the master clock in the brain. And what mm-hmm. you see is that we know that at certain times of day, of course, at night, melatonin levels go up, body temperature starts to drop, cortisol levels are low, right? And what happens is different parts of the day, there's different phase relationships. So, you know, usually if you go to bed hours later than you used to, you're going to end up sleeping in a different hormonal milieu. Right, a whole mm-hmm. whole different hormonal soup than you would if you had gone to bed at the time that you usually do. And, you know, now whether or not that is, you know, pathological, I think that there's some evidence that suggests that it is, but that is, you know, one thing that is kind of, you know, that I'm suspicious of that. And but anyway, that's one way that light is enters into the into the eye and affects these rhythms.
So is it all light, or I've heard a lot about this just being a blue light problem, or is it any light?
Yeah, it's a great question, because there's definitely an emphasis on discussions around this, around blue light, and the spectrum of light does matter. But the things that do matter are the intensity of the light, the wavelength or the spectrum, and then the duration, how long light is acting on the eye. So the intensity is actually very, if there's any light at all, then it's entering your eye. If you can see at all, light is entering your eye, and it has the potential to affect your rhythms. But most potently, blue light will affect your circadian rhythms more than anything else. And so it's, you know, you can think of, well, in the evening then, or during the day, we getting a lot of bright blue light, which makes sense being outside. And that's going to, again, be a direct stimulator of cortical activity. So if you want to feel like you're having a cup of coffee, you know, get outside, walk around, get some light in. And outside light is much stronger intensity than inside light. And it's more so than that's even, you know, appear so. So it's light is measured, the intensity of light is measured on a logarithmic scale. So outside light is measured in lux, and it can be over 100,000 lux, where, you know, room or, you know, inside light is, you know, 200 lux. So it's much, much lower in intensity. And intensity definitely shifts our rhythms. And we know that if you are getting, you know, if you're outside during the day, then you're going to have a much more robust melatonin rhythm at night. So being inside will decrease your, during the day, will decrease your melatonin at night by about 50%. So what we end up having is this process, unfortunately, of asynchronization. And, you know, what I mean by that is we're spending a lot of our time indoors during the day, right, with not a lot of light and not a lot of physical activity. And then in the evenings, we've got a lot of artificial light and a lot of things that are stimulating and keeping us up. And at night, we might have also, you know, clocks and windows open and other sorts of light, a night light on. That itself can also suppress melatonin. So not getting enough daytime light will suppress melatonin. Getting too much nighttime or evening light will suppress melatonin as well. And so overall, you know, we know melatonin is a really fascinating hormone, has a lot of potential positive effects on, particularly like on cancers and antimicrobial agents, or it is an antimicrobial agent. And if we're getting, you know, if a natural amount of darkness in a natural living environment is somewhere, depending on the season, like let's say 10 hours, we're now getting 6, we've truncated that by 4 hours per night. We're not getting the benefit of that hormone, you know, acting throughout the body and exerting, you know, having the ability to kind of exert its benefits.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, of course, what you described, not enough light during the daytime and too much light at night. That's probably one of the primary factors of the modern lifestyle that's driving this sleep epidemic. Someone who goes to work in an office and is exposed to artificial light, you know, or very little natural light during the day, and then they go home and there's, you know, the iPad and all the various technological devices emitting light, and it's kind of a double whammy effect.
Yeah.
Dan, is there like a minimum? So what Chris just talked about, I'm sure a lot of listeners, including myself, are in that situation. Is there a minimum level of daytime light we should try to achieve?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I don't know we have an answer to it. You know, what is that minimal threshold that we need to surpass in order to maintain these normal rhythms? Well, I would say that getting morning light is definitely important. That serves as an anchor to. So I think, you know, waking up in the morning, getting outside, and getting light for, you know, a good 10, 15, 20 minutes is a really smart thing. Particularly if you do any fasting, by the way, because I'm not, you know, I do intermittent fasting myself, and I think that there's some really interesting science behind it. I know it's not for everybody, but I'll just bring it up to mention that if you do fasting, then it is important, I think, to get bright light exposure first thing in the morning. Because what a lot of people might have to do if they're fasting is that their circadian rhythm will shift, right? The body's always trying to listen to understand what part of the day, you know, are we in, right? That's how you travel to, you know, Europe, where you basically change time zones. Over time, the body's taking in signals, not only light, but also sleep, physical activity, food, those to much to a lesser degree than light, but they are affecting the circadian rhythms.
they're going to eventually help you shift and get onto that schedule where that schedule now feels normal. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's all of those things, you know, really do matter. And I think what you see, actually you see this in people that will do fasting for religious purposes, that what happens is that over the course, usually a month long, over the first couple of days, they basically shift their schedule. So even though they're fasting, they're able to eat at night. And so they end up having, you know, being up at night much longer than they normally would be if they weren't fasting. So be careful of that. Get a lot of bright light exposure if you do a fasting, particularly in the morning. And then I would also say getting outside a couple of times a day whenever you can does make sense.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to move this into a more practical direction. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about biphasic and polyphasic sleep. I know we both saw this article in the New York Times last Sunday. Maybe some of you all saw it that was saying that we don't really need 8 hours of continuous uninterrupted sleep, and that that's, you know, not from an evolutionary perspective, that probably wasn't natural. So what do you think about that, Dan, and how applicable that is to, if that's even true, and how applicable it is to our modern situation?
Yeah, so the author, David Randall, you know, wrote an interesting article, and there's a few things that I thought were really good points, and there was a few things that I thought were, you know, were not accurate. And this is actually similar. A BBC article came out probably 6 or 8 months ago, and it was very similar to this, and it talked about this first and second sleep, and it was referencing the work of a historian from Virginia Tech. I'm trying to remember his name. It's Eckerk, I think. And this researcher was looking in historical texts, and he kept noticing references to, you know, this first period of sleep and second period of sleep. And basically what he identified is that there a natural sleeping pattern for people, you know, pre-industrialization, pre-modern lifestyle, where they would just have candlelight, is they would go to bed when, you know, soon after sundown. They would sleep for a period of time, then they would wake up and have this, you know, alertness in the middle of the night, and then they would go back to sleep and sleep for the remainder of the night. And both articles seem to suggest that that is the more natural pattern, and they use that as a way to condemn the 8-hour, you know, monophasic consolidated chunk of sleep. And I don't think that the evidence supports that, right? Just because there's suggestions that an alternative or another pattern of sleep and wake might not have any, you know, might not have any harm, you're not necessarily condemning the eight hour monophasic, you know, sleeping in one 8-hour chunk, right? And the point that he brings up is that people that are, you know, when you get really concerned about getting your 8 hours, it can cause anxiety. And without a doubt, that's a good point, is that anxiety, Cliff Saper, who's the dean of the Harvard Neurology Department, said insomnia is an anxiety disorder. That's first and foremost, that's what it is. And, you know, people get worried about something, they start to ruminate on an idea, and then eventually, whatever was the kind of instigating stimulus that stimulates the insomnia, eventually it can just turn into, you know, this positive feedback loop. Now you're worried about the insomnia, and that's preventing you from sleeping. So anxiety is a problem, for sure, for people that have insomnia. And we all experience that, you know, every once in a while, you know, and some people more frequently, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is, you know, it's the, as we discussed earlier, the real problem in our society is lack of sleep. So we're not getting enough sleep on a nightly basis. And at least it seems that way. And at least, and we're getting, you know, enough sleep to a degree that we'll see very significant, you know, very significant impairments in cognition. If you were to look at those same situations under a lab condition. And so the fact that an awakening is not an awakening, right? If you are getting all the sleep that you need and you wake up in the middle of the night, and okay, then that's fine. You don't necessarily have insomnia, right? But if you are not getting enough sleep and you still can't sleep, then that doesn't mean that you're not necessarily, well, you don't need that sleep. It might be that you have temporarily a sleep issue. So I think that there were some couple points that weren't made as well as I would like for him to have. What were your thoughts on the article, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was just an interesting historical perspective, but I didn't really see anything in there. I mean, even if we were talking about pre-industrialization, doesn't necessarily give us any insight into what was happening, you know, pre-Western civilization. And I think obviously we're in a really different place right now. And so even if a biphasic sleep pattern worked in a pre-industrial society where people were getting more sleep overall and probably having a lot more, maybe more sleep during the day and leisure time. I think one of the things that article pointed out is that even still in several other cultures, it's acceptable to take a nap during the daytime, even at the office, you know, people just put their heads down. So it was interesting to me, but the question definitely arises of how applicable sleep patterns in pre-industrial civilizations are to our current situation now.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And I'll, you know, I'll tell you about, there's a model called the two-process sleep and wake model. And I think it's actually really illuminating for this topic. This was a model that was published by a researcher, Alexander Pourbaix, in 1983. And it is the most cited sleep article, I think, in, you know, that we have today. It's been incredibly influential in our understanding about how sleep works. So in that model, there's basically these two different processes that are influencing your level of sleepiness or alertness at any point over a 24-hour period. And the first process is called sleep pressure. Right, it's this, you know, theoretical construct about to explain this observed behavior, but this observation that is that we see in various elements of the lab. I won't go into that, but what the idea is that sleep pressure builds from the moment you wake up. It builds, and however, you don't necessarily feel sleepier from the moment you wake up. Not at all, right? Usually, you might have a little, you know, sleep inertia, which means you're a little groggy for the first hour. That's totally normal. Not everybody experiences that. But then you stay somewhat stable over the course of the day. And that's because there is this opposing force, which is called your wake drive, right? And that is basically counterbalancing this building. Your wake drive is counterbalancing this building sleep pressure. And then in the evening, the wake drive will actually dissipate. It'll start to waxes and wanes. It has this cyclicity. And now all of a sudden you have this unopposed sleep pressure, and that facilitates sleep onset, and it also will help to maintain sleep maintenance, right, if you have enough pressure. And so what happens when you take a nap during the day? Well, you wear off some of that sleep pressure, right? And a lot of people, if they're not getting enough sleep on a nightly basis, then that's okay. They're actually helping to wear down some of their sleep debt, and they have really measurable performance improvements. The other way to do that is to sleep longer at night. But for people that are getting fully sleep satiated, if you take a nap in the afternoon, then what you're going to see is the sleep latency, or the time to fall asleep, is increased. And then also you might, if you wake up in the middle of the night, you might not have enough sleep pressure to maintain sleep throughout the night. And so that's the model that we're really working with. And then we have to think about how that then fits within the society. Are we talking about, as you referenced, in China, India, or Spain, where they allow for naps? You know, because if you, let's say you become dependent on a nap, but your culture, society, or your workplace, you know, you don't actually get that on a regular basis, you may behaviorally, you may become to expect a nap at 3 o'clock. And if you don't get one, you're going to practically fall asleep in your meeting, right? So it kind of depends on the context of the culture that you're in too, whether or not, you know, naps are beneficial or not.
This has been fascinating. And I would love to now maybe just spend a few minutes breaking this down into some tips that people can follow in terms of ensuring good sleep hygiene. And maybe, you know, obviously we can't address all of the issues that can cause problems with sleep in 5 minutes, let alone a single podcast or even 10. But maybe just some general guidelines for ensuring good sleep. And you talked about the importance of getting some light exposure in the morning and throughout the day. But what are some other things that you talk about within the context of Dan's plan?
Yeah, sure. So that's, kind of going back to kind of operationalizing sleep, you know, how do you then, you know, try to get the best outcome from, you know, with a knowledge set. So you believe now, okay, sleep's important. I want to get the best sleep that I can. What do I do? Well, we look at day, evening, and night as opportunities to affect this process. And the first, you know, as we talked about in the beginning, timing, intensity, and duration are three of the most important things to focus on. So most people have an idea about duration, or at least you can think about it. So over the course of a week or two, you can think about how much sleep do I need to get for me to feel my best. And then you can backtrack, because a lot of people have fixed wake-up times, either due to work schedules or school schedules. So you can then work back and say, okay, if I need 8 hours of sleep, I know that I need to go to bed at 11 o'clock. And what you do is you form an intention, right? That now you have a clear, tangible time in your mind. That's your goal. You want to be in bed by that time. And that's really important because, remember, as we're up at night, if we've got other sorts of stimulating influences like television, et cetera, like let's say if you do watch TV at night and, you know, you're deciding on whether to watch another episode and it's 10:45, but you want to be in bed at, 11. Well, if you didn't really have a clear objective in mind, it would be very easy to just put on another show. But if you do, then you can, and you care about that, then now you're getting consistent timing because you're trying to then, we try to gamify that, right? And we color code your score around your bedtime based off of how close you are to it, right? So now that kind of makes it more interesting and relevant and salient. So that's one thing that you can do. And actually addresses basically two out of the three. So timing, right? So that's the time that you go to bed and then the duration. And then the third one is intensity, and that has more to do with the things that we were talking about earlier. You can't get more sleep by squinting harder, right? I mean, you can't do it it's not an action, but there are actions that you can do in the beginning of the day that can facilitate that. And what we know is that, sleep is dependent. It's dependent on the usage of our body and mind over the day. So when you get more physical activity during the day, you will fall asleep sooner, you'll stay asleep longer. Light exposure first thing in the morning, well, we talked about how that affects melatonin. Of course, melatonin will influence sleep rhythms and circadian rhythms. And so getting, I think the other thing is controlling your light environment, getting light in the morning, outdoor light several times during the day, try to have bright light at your office place, and then in the evening, tone down the lights, change the tone of the lights from blue to more amber tones. And then try to keep your sleep environment cool, calm, quiet, and dark. Those are the things that are going to help to facilitate, really good sleep while you're in bed. But you see that most of that guidance is happening outside of bed, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So those are the things that you can, I think, that really do to try to nurture and encourage, good sleep on a daily basis. But just prioritizing it, recognize it's important, forming that intention about what time to go to bed, doing some tracking, which is really simple, but then it'll help to create mindfulness about if you're doing it or not, can make a huge difference. And we need tools that help counteract these forces and stimuli that keep us up. So I would say count on that you do, right? Because these things are going to be very persuasive. And again, it's easiest to go to sleep when you're sleepy, but there are reasons why we don't necessarily feel sleepy using sleep.
Well, I think that really sums up some of the best approaches you can take. And it really, a lot of it seems to really boil down to awareness and intention.
Yeah. Forming that intention, being aware of yourself. And, I'll share an anecdote. There's not a linear correlation between knowledge on a health subject and how healthy you are. Right. Mm-hmm. And just because you know a lot about something does not necessarily mean that you're going to live that lifestyle that's going to facilitate that. Right. Like the professor emeritus at some university on nutrition doesn't necessarily have the best nutrition, herself. So the point that I'm making is that a while ago, I've been coaching and educating on sleep. And if somebody asked me how much sleep I was getting, I would have told them 8 hours, like absolutely. But I was tracking my sleep and I was getting just over 7. So I was getting basically an hour less than I thought I was. And so that tracking can really help you understand what's really happening versus what you think you're doing. And so it just makes it a lot easier to then do some course correction so that you can say, okay, you know what? I'm not getting quite the sleep that I need, that I know that I need for me to feel my best. So let me make some adjustments. And I think that can keep us on track.
And that's, of course, equally true for physical activity, I think, which we'll have to have you back on to talk about another time.
I'd love to.
Thanks for coming on the show, Dan. It's been great. I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to the next time we can have you on.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's a real pleasure for me.
So everybody, check out Dan's Plan again, www.dansplan.com. You can sign up for an account there for free and get started tracking all this stuff and set your goals for sleep and activity and weight. And if you're like the vast majority of my patients, it's going to help you a lot. So that's it for this week. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
That was a fascinating show, and I hope that everyone enjoyed it as much as I did. And we want to thank you for listening today, and please keep sending us your questions to chriskresser.com using the podcast submission link. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. It helps us with our rankings. It helps this show reach more people so we can change more lives. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.